is Emily Wright, tech editor and head of special projects at EG, and here we are on day two of LREF, and it's a lovely environment to be in despite the rain. It is a little bit noisy out there, which is good because it means that people are chatting and networking. It does make it slightly challenging for this podcast, but I'm here with three seasoned professionals, and all of whom have been on the podcast before, and I know we'll be able to make it work and do the best with what we've got. So I'm going to welcome our podcast guests, Susan Freeman, partner at Michigan Dorea, Dan Hughes, founder of Alpha Property Insight, and Andy Pyle, head of UK real estate at KPMG UK. Thank you all so much for joining me here today. It's an exciting one. We're talking about mapping. This is something that we've been looking into a lot at EG recently. It's the theme of our last EG Tech magazine. We're looking at mapping in terms of sort of explicitly mapping and location apps, but then also looking at what it means in a wider context in terms of data and the fact that basically everything, when you look at it, really is about a map. So, Susan, I'm going to start with you. How would you define mapping technology? I know that Michigan have been working quite a lot with land registry and sort of bringing together various elements to get more involved with this side of the industry.
I think, put it at its most basic, it's just the process by which data is compiled and formatted into some sort of virtual image. I think that's about it in my view.
Thank you very much. And Dan.
Good morning. So I think the thing about the real estate is it's that more than any other, it's a real estate, is a location business. And location is the most important factor for all sorts of things. And so location data, as things become more technological, becomes more and more important. And mapping is really just a visual interface for humans to understand that location data. So mapping really is just a visual interpretation of location data, and that location data can be used more and more in a computer as the computers get more powerful, or it can be interpreted by a human from a map.
Thank you very much. And Andy?
Well, I mean, I just to probably add to what Susan and Dan have said, I think there's, for me, a lot of this is about how people interact with the built environment. And so I think what mapping technology can actually do is give us a much better sense of how individuals are moving around, the locations that they're in, and therefore, as Dan said, you know, real estate is all about location. And so mapping technology at its essence is actually giving us more insight into location and what that means for the sorts of buildings and built environment we actually need. So it's incredibly powerful.
Mm. I mean, one thing that I wanted to touch on just before we get into whether there's enough understanding of mapping and how we should use it, is that we recently interviewed Ed Parsons of Google Maps, who was a formerly Ordnance Survey, who made the point that, you know, the mapping apps and the platforms that we all carry around on our phones effectively make everybody a surveyor, really. And everybody is, you know, feeding information in to this sort of huge worldwide collection of data, which is effectively one huge mapping platform. So there's something quite familiar about mapping for everybody. It's something that we all do. We check Google Maps, you might check City Map or whatever it is. Do you think that makes it a bit more easy for people to get their heads around? You know, a lot of technology is sort of shrouded in mystery, and mapping is something that we're all quite familiar with. And actually, I think a lot of people are quite sort of intrigued by it. Susan, there was a question in there somewhere. I don't know if you want to try and find it using your mapping skills.
Yeah, no, I think that was a very good question. And I'm not sure how clear people are that they are being used to provide all this information. So you take, for instance, Waze, which you know, is a traffic app that a lot of us use driving around cities. And I think a lot of people are a bit unsure about the idea that they, you know, they're giving away data, albeit anonymized. And I think that, you know, there's going to be a bit of a pushback, concern about, you know, data privacy and that sort of thing. So I think people don't necessarily know. They turn their phones on, they'll use an app, they're providing useful information, but they don't necessarily know that they are.
So Dan, this is a perfect point for you to come in and comment here, because this is where data and mapping collide, which must be, you know, wonderful news for you. Your two favourite subjects.
I know, I get very excited. That's not a good thing, is it? So I think there are two points. I think building on what Susan said is, she's absolutely right that people giving away data is, I think, great, as long as people know that they're giving away data. And I think the problem is when people don't know that they're giving it away. So Google Maps, for example, is an incredibly expensive project, but doesn't cost anything for most people, for consumers to use. And the way that you pay for that really is through the data that you provide and doing things. And as long as people understand that, I think that's fine. I think your other question was around data and mapping and people help engaging with that. And a map is something that we've had for years and decades and centuries, and they've just been around for so long that it's just a very easy interface for people to get an awful lot of information in a pretty straightforward diagram. So even if you look at the most basic sense of, in property, if you have a list of 50 assets, you can put it into a spreadsheet. It's very difficult to get a feel for where they are and what they're doing. Put those dots on a map, which is about as simplistic as you can get, and it still gives you a really good flavour of what's happening, and it can tell you an awful lot about it, about where they are and how they're clustered and what the risks are and so on.
Thank you very much. And Andy, sort of similar question to you, but from your perspective and your area of expertise, how do you view these mapping technologies and the way that we use to track data in terms of the wider prop tech or tech market at the moment?
Well, I think the points that there's a big point and a big question around the whole ethics and informed consent piece around what consumers are they aware of what's happening to their data? And, you know, one of the phrases I really like is actually, you know, you're not the customer, you're the product, because actually in many cases, individuals' data aggregated and hopefully anonymized is actually something which, you know, the companies want to do, and they do a whole bunch of things with it. So that there's definitely an ethics piece around this. I think that maps are incredibly, because they've been around for hundreds of years, as Dan says, they're incredibly intuitive at a basic use case level for everybody to understand, because as you say, we use this every day just going about our daily business. I think the interesting thing for me, where some more interesting some newer prop tech companies are coming in, is in more sophisticated use cases. So, you know, ViewCity have got a stand here at LREF, you know, a great way of visualizing the 3D image of a city that will have and is having a big impact on the planning process. You've got other applications like What3Words, which is effectively giving an address to every single square meter of the planet. And of course, you know, from a social inclusion perspective, which is increasingly important, and in developing countries, you know, actually people not having an address and not being able to define, you know, where they live and potentially property rights, you know, this is potentially enormous. And it just goes to show, you know, in those two very different, more advanced use cases, as it were, the power that mapping technologies can actually have on everyday lives of individuals around the world.
I mean, I think that what we've touched on there, which is great because it's where I wanted to take the conversation anyway, so thank you very much, is that we've gone from talking about mapping apps and location tools to what the bigger issue is, really, which is the way that this feeds into to everything, really. It feeds into, you know, socioeconomic issues. It feeds into the way that we live, work and play. And I think that that's the bigger point that we're really good to discuss. And on that note, and I'll come back to you, Dan, if that's okay, do you think that the real estate sector is properly harnessing mapping and data and location, everything that it can do, to the best of its ability at the moment?
No. Would you like me to expand on that?
I would love
I think the answer is that real estate hasn't been that good at capturing data, and when we do capture it, it tends to be on a personal basis. So if you take an example of a building being sold and you look at addressing data, we will write down what we personally think of as that building. So it could be the big red shiny building on the corner. Now, capturing that as an address, actually for me, if I know what that means, is perfect. The problem is that I share that to everyone else around the table, and as soon as you start sharing it, we all have different interpretations. It doesn't mean anything. So real estate does capture data, but we capture it very much on a human individual basis as opposed to a systemic national basis. So addressing is a very simple example, but you need to start thinking about how we can capture stuff on a national, consistent, standardized way, which then allows other people to use it and other computers to use it. So we do capture data. I think we capture more data than people give us credit for, but we don't capture it in the right way for it to then be used across lots of other things. Mm. And if you look at location data, it's all about a computer understanding different location data sets and tying those together. So very few data sets are not geospatially linked in some shape or form. So actually, once you've got that infrastructure, you can compare and contrast all sorts of data sets. And it doesn't actually have to be a map. So just as a very simple example, I came here this morning, I used Google Maps, but all I did was put the location in and then I listened on my headphones to the directions. So I didn't look at a map once. And it's that location data that you need to be able to interpret that, even though there's no visual. So for real estate, we do capture data, but we've got to be much more consistent and standardized about it.
Mm. And a similar question to you, Susan. I'm interested to know, I mean, what Dan just mentioned there is really interesting about, you know, it doesn't always have to be a map, it's just the location data and how that's presented. Do you think there are opportunities there for the real estate sector to sort of look a bit more laterally at this?
I think it's actually wider, because we talk about real estate sector, but actually this is all about the built environment and smart cities. Mm. And for smart cities to work, we've got to have this mapping technology, I think, embedded in all city functions. So, you know, we talk a lot about autonomous vehicles and, you know, they are not going to be able to work unless we've got all this, you know, technology mapped, and everything is going to have to link into the system. So any concerns that people have about sharing data, I think they're going to have to, you know, get used to that, because that's how cities in the future are going to work. And the real estate sector is obviously sort of very much an integral part of, you know, smart cities of the future. So, I mean, it is so exciting. I mean, Andy mentioned View City, and, you know, in a relatively short space of time, you know, that product has just, you know, become, you know, very different from how it was at the outset. And I was just talking to them a few minutes ago, and they said that 21 of the London local authorities are now using View City as part of the planning process, and I'm sure it's only a matter of time before, you know, the others get on board as well. And, you know, the functions, you know, the functionality there is just completely revolutionised the planning process. Mm. So I think huge opportunities.
Andy, look like you have something to say in response.
No, just a couple of things. I think planning is one of the largest but often hidden costs that the real estate industry has. We talk a lot about where are the pain points. When you have a situation where it can take you 5-6 years from acquiring an interest in a site to actually having something physically built and occupied and producing income, even if the original acquisition cost is not that high relative to the finished value of the building, it's still a massive inefficiency. And so the ability for technology, mapping and otherwise, to improve the process of securing planning consent is absolutely enormous. And I think Susan also made a great point around smart cities, and actually her, what she said and what Dan said is exactly right, that if you're going to have smart cities and lots of different technologies being able to interact with each other, you know, consistency and standardization in terms of data and mapping technologies is going to be absolutely critical. And the biggest thing for me is, though, it's not just about capturing data. It's what you do with it, because, you know, data's fine, but you have to turn it into insight, which is really, for me, is something which is a non-obvious piece of information that you get from analysing the data. And then you have to do something with that and start making decisions. And if you look at some of the smartest apps that are there at the moment, that's what they're already doing. You know, the City Mapper live feed that tells you reroute because actually there's a problem on this particular tube line. Mm. Or there's a traffic jam here. They're using millions of data points that they're capturing all of the time, feeds from different systems, to tell me as a user that I should do something differently to make my journey more efficient. That's the sort of level that the challenge for the real estate industry is, to be able to work in, you know, in a way like that.
Dan, how far off do you think we are from that? Maybe some people are there already, you know, in terms of reacting and analysing data rather than just harvesting it.
I think that in real estate, we analyze data and have done for many years in a lot of ways. Often it's done in people's brains. So in real estate, there's some really clever people. Brains are the most powerful computer, so we use lots of data and insights to make decisions. The thing that's happening at the moment is it's starting to move into the computer. And as it moves into a computer, sometimes the human is better and sometimes the computer is better. And I think there are point examples where it has been put into a technology solution and it's being done very well. Andy's just mentioned some of those. I think one of the big things that's happened recently is it's become much more open to people with no training to do it. So GIS or geospatial analysis has been something that's been around for many years. It's not a new thing, but it's now becoming much easier for people to do because the experience is being improved all the time. So it's something you can quite easily engage with. So I think there are, I mean, data analysis is something that we've done for many years in the sector. It's becoming more and more technological, and I think people are starting to engage with it more all over the place.
There are a couple of points, that one that you made, Andy, and one that you just made, Dan, that got a round of applause. I'm not sure whether it was directly linked, but I'd take it if I were you. So. The other thing that I wanted to talk about was alternative data and alternative data sources, and whether or not the real estate sector, or as Susan pointed out, goes wider than that, and just, you know, looking at, you know, the world as a whole and smart cities, whether or not there's enough of a focus on using that alternative data. And when I say that, I'm, you know, talking about, you know, footfall and transport usage and where people are tweeting and what they're tweeting about. And could that mean that there is an opportunity to put a development here to respond to X, Y, and Z? So it's real life data coming from people or systems that maybe traditionally hasn't always been integrated into development. Susan, again, I, you know, congratulations if you can find the question in there, but I'm just interested to know whether the sector is using that as much as it should be.
I think the answer is probably no, but there is huge potential because those sources that that you mentioned are, you know, sources of information about how people are living their lives, you know, the pattern of, you know, the way they buy things, you know, where they go. And I mean, I think retail is probably a good sector to look at, because if you're thinking about where to open you know, a store, you really want to know, you know, what people are thinking about, you know, what, you know, what's going to drag them away from their computer screen to actually, you know, come to your store. And I think that there's a lot more that can be done in relation, you know, to shopping malls, for instance, but it actually requires collaboration between the people that own the shopping centres and the people that are running the shops in those centres and the customer. And I think there's still a little bit of reticence about sharing data. But I think, you know, with collaboration and people being comfortable with the sources that you mentioned. I mean, I think footfall is, you know, something that is being used quite a lot now, and it's essential, because otherwise, you know, what are you basing your evidence on? You know, you're opening a shop somewhere. You can't do it just on the basis you think it would be nice to open a shop there. It's got to be based on, you know, clear evidence. I think there's sort of exciting opportunities, but we're probably just in the foothills at the moment.
And Dan, you look like you had a point to make.
Yeah, so I agree with that completely, and I think retail's a really interesting one. So I do think real estate typically is behind with using a lot of these data sets, but I also think there's a really good reason for that, which is that the business case, if someone signs a 20-year lease, then actually you don't need to know what's going to happen tomorrow specifically, because you can't do anything about it. And if you look at retail, then as soon as people don't go into a shop, they're not buying stuff, so it affects revenue. Whereas if you've signed a 20-year lease on an office, then that's a much longer period to get the comeback. So using those data sets isn't so valuable. But what we're seeing recently is, as leases come down, in particular with things like co-working, all of a sudden it's becoming about much more about experience. It's about how you serve the customer. And that trend means that we need to look at many, many more data sets. So I think real estate has been a bit behind, but actually for good reason. And it's now starting to pick up and catch up with that.
Thank you. Andy?
Well, a couple of points for me. So firstly, I suppose we've, you know, yesterday we had the announcement that the Arcadia CVA had actually passed. So I think increasingly property is becoming operational, and actually even if there is a 10 or 15 year lease in place, you know, things can happen. One chief executive of a large property company, you know, said to me quite some time ago, you know, when we get into a lease arrangement with a retailer, we actually have the mindset that we are taking operational risk alongside the retailer, one way or another. So I think inevitably that will require more use of data. I think what's happened to date is people do track things like footfall, but I think people have been relatively limited in terms of the sort of data sets that they've tried to work with. Now, if you know where the retailers are going and other businesses is, they're trying to combine, you know, anonymized geospatial data like from mobile phone signals. They're looking at combining that with some of the demographic profiling data that you can get around where consumers are actually spending their money and the profile, the postcodes that they're living in and the postcodes that they're visiting. And they're trying to produce a much, much richer sort of tapestry of different data sets that you can then look to correlate and do some sophisticated analysis with, to just give you much more insight in terms of who's coming to your place from where, what is their profile, to let them then make a decision around, is this the right location for a store, and actually what should the product mix be in that store based on the sort of people that are actually visiting it. Because again, we've seen with some retailers there are, you know, if you tweak the product mix, you can actually make a really, really material difference to how well that store trades. And ultimately, I would say the real estate industry needs its customers to be successful in the space that they occupy, because it's only through that way will the industry actually thrive. So what the industry should be doing is also working with these rich data sets, so that then they can actually more proactively seek the right sort of retailers to be in their shopping centres or other facilities.
Thank you very much. We've got about 5 minutes left, and one of the things that I wanted to ask was whether there are any sectors that have successfully used mapping technology to innovate that real estate can learn from. I don't know who to start with on this one. Dan.
I think it's come up a couple of times. Retail tends to be quite good, and I think just to follow on from what Andy was saying, is absolutely right that what becomes really powerful is not so much the data that you collect. So having footfall is of some use, but when you start combining that with several other data sets, that becomes really quite insightful. So you can start really making some really good insights from that. And I think real estate, as Andy says, needs to work much closer with the occupiers to make sure that we're using the same type of things, because ultimately we've got the same questions, the same problems. I think also financial services can be quite good at this as well, especially when you look at things like insurance. So the understanding across a national level about buildings, it can be very impressive, and I think they use often a lot of data sets to make informed decisions or to reduce the amount of time that you need to spend putting in information about your building.
Thank you very much. Susan, same question to you.
Yes, I mean, I think in every area, people are having to get sort of smarter about how they do business, and you know, to get rid of the obstacles that slow things down. I mean, Andy talked about, talked about planning, and certainly, you know, in legal services, we're now using all sorts of artificial intelligence and different platforms to speed up how we do due diligence. So, we've got Orbital Witness, who are space scientists and use satellite imagery, and we are, you know, we're using that now in our due diligence process, which really speeds up, you know, transactions. So, you know, we talk about, you know, planning, but there's also, you know, the speed with which one's able to transact. So, you know, I just think the change at the moment is so exponential that, you know, it's very difficult to foresee how far forward we will have moved in, say, you know, this time next year. But I mean, just in practical terms, you know, we're all using this data to get round, you know, London, you know, for instance, and it's actually not very practical. Everybody's looking at their phones the whole time. So I think, you know, one thing which we'll probably see more about is wearables, and actually get back to, you know, the idea of smart glasses, so that you actually can see all this data without, you know, if you're driving, taking your, you know, eye off the road, and if you're walking along, you know, be able to walk along without looking at the telephone the whole time.
Thank you very much. And the same question to you, Andy.
I think most of the examples for me come from the sectors that are interfacing with individuals you know, on a regular basis. So if you look at retail, financial services, some of the individual mobility and transport sectors, you know, people are actually trying to use data in a more systematic way. I think and then as real estate becomes much more of a consumer facing industry and looking at the needs of individual users, I think that will only sort of serve to increase. The other thing which I think you have to do, though, in order to capture more data, is just to be prepared to experiment more often. And if you look at, you know, something like Amazon, you know, what do they do really, really well? Well, they do lots of things, but one of the things is they run a phenomenal number of experiments a year where they just change one thing in a particular area and then look at what happens. And then if it works, you then move into rolling it out. And so the other challenge for the real estate industry is going to be working out how does the industry experiment a little bit more, at a scale that is actually manageable and that people think is sensible in terms of risk. But, you know, I think whether that's using particular or trialing certain types of apps in individual buildings in your portfolio, or other sorts of ideas, you know, or trialing different business models, again, in certain parts of your portfolio, that sort of culture of experimentation and innovation is something which the industry, I would say, has historically not done. That will give you more data, and then you can actually start making really well-informed decisions rather than actually, you know, the gut feel and judgment where we've been so far.
We have just 1 minute left, and I'm going to spring a question on everybody, which I feel a bit bad about, but it's not a mean question. So, from doing the mapping issue of EG Tech and from talking to people, what I've worked realised is that a huge proportion of people really love maps. I'm one of those people. So I just wanted to go around the table and this is the geekiest question I've ever asked. Find out what everybody's favourite map is. And I will start to give everybody a bit of a chance to think about it. I have a map at home, which is a map of the shipping forecast regions, and I love it because I used to love listening to the shipping forecast, which is probably the second geekiest thing I've ever said, certainly on a podcast. So that's mine, a map of the shipping forecast. Susan, what's your favourite map?
Well, I have to admit that my very favourite map, actually, if we're talking about digital mapping, is Waze. Now, I used to be able to drive down London very happily on my own without a Waze map to tell me, but now I actually, as soon as I turn on the engine, I turn on Waze, and then it's a race to actually see whether my route is going to be any quicker. But I absolutely, you know, I'm a real fan of Waze.
Thank you very much. Dan, what's your favourite map?
It is a geeky question. I'm inclined to give a geeky answer and say it's not so much about the maps, it's about the location data underneath. But I think if there is a map specifically, I'd say the undergrounds, the tube map. And I think one of the reasons is that the skill of a map is actually making sure that it's got stuff on that's relevant, but nothing more. And I think that the tube map does that brilliantly. So it's not true to anything else, but it gets the message across perfectly.
Thank you. And Andy, finally, what's your favourite map?
Well, I might have gone for the tube map as well. It doesn't work so well if you're colourblind, of course, but there we go. We've got a map at home which is sort of, you know, a couple of hundred years old. The village in which we live is right at the middle of it, and you can just see how different the world actually was. So I really like looking actually at older maps. That would probably be my favourite because it's personal.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Well, it's one of my favourite ways to end a podcast ever. One of my favourite ways to end a podcast ever. Lovely to hear about fellow map lovers. And if anyone's still listening to this, I'm sure you feel like you found out a lot more about me, Susan, Dan and Andy than you knew before. Thank you very much for joining me.